Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman. Files containing the names of 22,000 ISIS members could have been exposed. Germany's Federal Criminal Police are saying they are in possession of files containing personal data on members of the extremist Islamic State group and believe them to be authentic. This announcement comes after Britain's Sky News reported it had obtained 22,000 Islamic State files on the border with Turkey and Syria. Files that detail IS fighters' real names, where they come from, telephone numbers, even names of those who sponsored and recruited the militants. These files could be the largest yet treasure trove of documents found on IS and the most significant leak on its fighters and operations across the Mideast. It could also significantly shape the campaign against the extremist group, which emerged from Al-Qaeda in Iraq. The cache exposing its members and their families could undermine its future ability to recruit and inspire would-be members. The broadcaster said the files were passed on to them on a memory stick stolen from the head of Islamic State's internal security police by a former fighter who had grown disillusioned with the group. Austria's Interior Ministry says refugees stuck at Greece's border with Macedonia must understand that they have no chance of crossing. Johanna Mikkel-Leitner told reporters in Brussels that the most honest thing is to tell the refugees it is impossible to get through the Balkan route anymore. The Balkan route is closed. She says the biggest problem is that these refugees still have hopes and expectations, and these hopes are being constantly fed. Mikkel-Leitner says it's important to warn that the Balkan migrant route into Europe is closed because she says that way you don't feed any hopes and expectations. This is VOA News. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden Thursday told U.S. troops who are training the Jordanian military that Islamic State extremists are already on their heels, but defeating them will take a long time. Biden also told the U.S. military instructors that Islamic State militants do not pose an existential threat to the United States. The vice president arrived in Jordan earlier Thursday. In the capital of Amman, he met with King Abdullah II, a key Western military ally. Washington has scaled up military aid to Jordan in recent months in line with the kingdom's central role in the fight against IS, which controls large areas of neighboring Syria and Iraq. Longtime Myanmar opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi has released a letter to her supporters apologizing for not becoming the country's next president. A clause in the military written constitution prevents her from assuming the nation's top job because her sons have foreign citizenship. Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy Party won an overwhelming number of seats in parliament during November's general election. After her letter was released on social media Thursday, the lower house of parliament, controlled by the NLD Thursday, chose party member Kim Jaw as its nominee for vice president. The entire parliament is expected to vote on March 18th to decide which of three vice presidential finalists becomes the nation's next president. North Korea fired two short-range ballistic missiles into the sea Thursday in defiance of UN Security Council resolutions as South Korean and U.S. forces conducted massive war games. The North also announced it had scrapped all agreements with the South on commercial exchange projects and would liquidate South Korean assets left behind in its territory. North Korea has a large stockpile of short-range missiles and is developing long-range and intercontinental missiles as well. South Korea's defense ministry said Thursday the missiles flew about 500 kilometers into the sea off the east coast city of Wonsan and probably were part of the Soviet-developed Scud series. Japan, which is within range of the longer-range variant of the Scud missile or the upgraded Rodong missile, lodged a protest through the North Korean embassy in Beijing. The Japanese Red Cross Society says thousands of families and elderly people are still displaced 5 years after the earthquake and tsunami that devastated the country's northeast coastline and set off a meltdown at the Fukushima nuclear plant. In a statement Thursday, the Red Cross said some 170,000 people are either housed in temporary or rented accommodation or have moved to other parts of the country to restart their lives. I'm Ira Melman.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Children are killed, they are maimed, schools are occupied, destroyed, attacked, radicalization of very young children to commit violence. You know, the practice by Boko Haram, for example, of using girls as a suicide bomb. There are a large number of children recruited in South Sudan, in Somalia and in other places.
That's Leila Zarugi, the special representative of the Secretary General for Children and Armed Conflict. She says conflicts are having a devastating impact on children. We'll have full details coming up.
Also, a new UN report says 34 countries, nearly all of them in Africa, do not have enough food for their populations. And Turkey's state-run news agency says 5 migrants, including a 3-month-old baby, drowned today when their boat sank off the Greek island of Lesbos.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny, music from Nigeria, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, a new UN report says 34 countries, nearly all of them in Africa, do not have enough food for their populations. The Food and Agriculture Organization blames conflicts, droughts, and floods. It says all those countries need outside food assistance. The FAO says agricultural production has been battered by conflicts in Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Somalia, and Central African Republic. As a result, humanitarian crises in those countries have worsened. The effects of conflict have also caused problems in neighboring countries hosting refugees. As for drought, the El Niño weather phenomenon has sharply reduced crop production in many southern and eastern African countries. But food shortages are also reported elsewhere on the continent, including Mali, Mauritania, Niger, Sierra Leone, Chad, Liberia, and Guinea. Dry conditions are also reported in Central America and the Caribbean for the third year in a row. Droughts and floods have also hit North Korea's agricultural sector very hard in 2015.
Armed conflicts around the world showed no signs of easing in 2015 and have had a devastating impact on children. The special representative of the Secretary General for Children and Armed Conflict, Leila Zarugi, presented these findings to the UN Human Rights Council this week. Her annual report covered the period between December 2014 and December 2015. It found that children were victims of horrific violations as a result of conflicts in Nigeria, South Sudan, Somalia, Yemen, Iraq, and Syria. Zarugi spoke with me about the high price children are paying for the actions of adults.
We raised the major concern that we have is about extreme violence affecting children in area where extreme armed groups are operating, but also the counter-response to these groups, counter-terrorism in general, policy and military intervention, either inside the country or when it comes to area where you have now coalition, either coalition led by one country as it is in Yemen or several coalition as it is the case in Syria, in Iraq, but also, as you know, in Nigeria. So very dire situation. Children are recruited in huge number. Children are killed. They are maimed. Schools are occupied, destroyed, attacked, radicalization of very young children to commit violence. You know, the practice by Boko Haram, for example, of using girls as a suicide bomb. There are a large number of children recruited in South Sudan, in Somalia, and in other places. So these are the feature that we have. We have also the detention of children because of their association with armed groups, which is another challenge that we are facing, where children are not anymore treated as primarily as victims, but as a security threat and as a criminals, and they are detained without any legal framework, without any protection outside of the judicial system, far away from the juvenile system and the juvenile standards. We have so many children that have been killed during 2015, a high number in many contexts. I announced that this year was worse than the year before, and this is ongoing, same trend since 2013.
What are you calling for the international community to do regarding the conflicts that are going on and its effect on children?
We are, first of all, asking member states to take the necessary measures to mitigate the risk that children are facing when it comes to military operations, to respect international humanitarian law and human rights law and refugee law. We are asking those who are recruiting children and helping children to release the children. We are asking for proper program for reintegration of those who are released, because if we would like to prevent their re-recruitment, their abuse by other armed groups or parties, it's important that programs are in place. We are asking for protection of schools from military use and from attacks, because this is affecting the future of the next generation. We are also highlighting the progress made by some member states and the setback in some countries because of conflict or because of lack of will, as it is the case in Yemen, in Sudan, but also what is happening in Libya, in Syria and Iraq.
The campaign Children Not Soldiers, it's in its second year now. So how successful has this campaign been?
We are very pleased with the result with the campaign, because first of all, we achieved progress. Out of the seven, six already signed an action plan. I am going at the end of the month to finalize the latest country that did not sign, Sudan. We are now in the final process, and they already endorsed the draft, and we will be signing, which means that all member states concerned adhere to the principle that they don't want children in their army and would like to turn the page for this recruitment. We have highlighted the progress made by Congo, by Afghanistan, under very difficult circumstances, DRC, Afghanistan, also working with Somalia, and as I said, Sudan. So this is the progress. We have, as I said, the setback in Yemen, the setback in South Sudan. It was also an opportunity for us to engage with non-state actors, because member states that are adhering to the principle are raising the concern with regard to the practice by non-state actors. We already engaged using the peace processes as a tool, an opportunity and space, working with the FARC in Colombia, working with the three armed group in Darfur. Riek Machar signed recently an action plan with the United Nations to end the practice in South Sudan. We need to make sure that Mao government forces be listed in the next report and armed group adhere to the same principle.
Leila Zarugi is the special representative of the Secretary General for Children and Armed Conflict. She spoke with me from Geneva.
Turkey's state-run news agency says five migrants, including a three-month-old baby, drowned today when a speedboat taking them to Greece sank off the island of Lesbos. Nine others from Afghanistan and Iran reportedly were rescued. Meanwhile, a proposed deal between Turkey and the European Union to swap Syrian refugees one for one may be only temporary. The deal says for every Syrian refugee settled by the EU, Turkey must settle a refugee from one of the Greek islands. The Dutch migration minister says the swap is not a permanent mechanism. Netherlands currently holds the six-month rotating presidency of the 28-nation EU bloc. At the same time, the UN human rights chief is denouncing the proposal between Turkey and the EU, calling it a race to repel migrants and refugees. Zid Raad al-Hussein says he will raise his concerns at the EU summit next week. Also today, authorities in northern Greece say about 70 children at a camp on the Greek-Macedonian border have received hospital treatment for fever and diarrhea. An estimated 14,000 people are camped out near the border town of Idomeni. Many have sought cover from torrential rains. However, the camp in Idomeni was built to hold only 1,500 people. Meanwhile, German and Greek leaders have blasted Balkan countries for shutting their borders to migrants ahead of today's EU ministers' meeting. However, EU President Donald Tusk welcomed the route closure.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Hayes Wuhib, 15 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. A new UN report says 34 countries, most of them in Africa, do not have enough food for their populations. And armed conflicts around the world, which showed no signs of abating in 2015, has had a devastating impact on children. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
Reuters reports a senior Islamic State militant says he's the new leader of the terrorist group in Libya, and he's warning neighboring countries that Islamic State is getting stronger every day. Abdul Qader al-Naji says the neighboring countries would not be able to defend themselves from attacks. The group has taken advantage of the political turmoil and chaos in Libya to greatly expand its operations. Italy estimates the group has 5,000 fighters in Libya. Islamic State has been blamed for a series of attacks on a Tunisian border town in recent days that have left at least 50 people dead, most of them militants. Reuters says Tunisia is bolstering its southern border with barriers and trenches.
The government of Burundi says that no civilians were killed after the December 11th attack on military bases by armed militants. However, a case has been opened regarding three police officers who may have been involved in the deaths of seven armed men who had been captured. Their bodies were later found in the countryside. From Bujumbura, Moses Havyarimana reports.
Last December's confrontation was one of the bloodiest between the security forces and armed groups after the attack on four military bases, three of them in Bujumbura. Human rights groups and activists said that many of the victims were civilians, especially those living in the suburbs that are believed to be strongholds of the opposition. Earlier this year, Amnesty International released satellite images showing mass graves after the confrontation. Burundi's Attorney General, Valentin Bagurikunda, spoke to the press today about the death of the seven captured fighters.
Les sept combattants capturés à Mujejuru ont été retrouvés morts dans des circonstances non encore élucidées.
Burundi's Attorney General says that it's not clear how the seven fighters who were captured in Mujejuru were killed. He says a case has been opened and three security officials will be charged in relation to the killings in order to find out the identity of the perpetrator. Opposition leaders accuse government security forces of attacking and killing those who protested against President Pierre Nkurunziza's third term. The United Nations Independent Investigation on Burundi blamed both government and opposition for human rights violations that have taken place since last year. Burundi's Attorney General says an investigation was launched 6 days after the attack. The inquiry found no signs of torture or ill treatment by the security forces and stated that all of the armed men killed during the attack were handed over to their families. But he says those who could not be identified were buried in public cemetery and not in mass graves.
Par ailleurs, il a été constaté que les allégations faisaient état de l'existence des fosses communes.
He says The investigation found no mass graves. In fact, he says only one grave was found in an opposition neighborhood of Bujumbura. The government says that the opposition is responsible for the deaths of the people who did not want to participate in protests. Mr. Bagorikunda says 87 armed people who were captured and arrested are in Muramvya prison, and that the number of those captured was higher than those who were killed in the fighting. According to the United Nations, more than 400 people have been killed since last April. That's when violence erupted after the incumbent president vied for a third term in the office, a move that critics say violates the country's constitution and the Arusha Agreement, signed over 10 years ago, that brought an end to civil war. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
A new study says domestic violence during pregnancy greatly increases the risk of preterm birth, low birth weight, and other problems. Researchers evaluated abuse cases of 15,000 women in 17 countries. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
University of Iowa researchers weighed the findings of more than 50 studies on domestic violence by a partner or ex-partner. Professor of Epidemiology Audrey Saflis is the lead author.
We know that intimate partner violence affects women primarily of reproductive age. Younger women in the reproductive age range are even more affected than women who are in the older end of the reproductive age range. So women who are under 25 and women who are under 20 are at particularly high risk of intimate partner violence.
She outlines some of the consequences of being a victim of domestic violence during pregnancy.
Specifically, we found a doubling of risk for having a baby that was born before term. So babies that were preterm, born before 37 weeks of gestation. And we found an increased risk for delivering a baby that was low birth weight or less than 2,500 grams at time of birth. And we found an increased risk of having a baby that was small for its gestational age.
Researchers say the most common forms of domestic violence against women are physical, sexual, financial, psychological, and emotional.
We found that women who were exposed to two or more forms of violence had higher risks of preterm delivery and low birth weight than women who were exposed to one form of violence. So, for example, if a woman was exposed to physical abuse and emotional abuse, her risk was higher than that of a woman who was exposed to physical abuse alone.
Saflis says the study did not have detailed information on the frequency or the timing of the violence, but it did show that domestic violence and its effects were the same whether in a rich country or a low or middle-income country.
To translate our findings into practice, it'll be important for obstetricians, gynecologists, GPs who see pregnant women during the time of pregnancy to understand and be able to identify the signs of abuse and also have the ability and training to refer that woman to resources that can help her.
She says some signs of domestic abuse are easily seen. Others are not.
There are physical signs of violence, and there are sometimes sexual signs of violence. For example, women who are in relationships where there is partner violence are more likely to be diagnosed with sexually transmitted diseases. Other presenting conditions that suggest intimate partner violence include women presenting with sometimes with very nonspecific pain syndromes, psychological and mental disorders such as depression.
She also says many women in abusive relationships have their opinions discounted or ignored. They're even told that what they're saying sounds crazy. And over time, she says, some believe they do have a mental illness. The University of Iowa professor says if the signs of domestic abuse are recognized, interventions can be made. These include home visitation and counseling programs, as well as advocacy and mentor support programs.
Many of these programs may seem to be effective, but it's important that further research be done to actually test whether these interventions are actually effective in preventing and reducing intimate partner violence for these women.
The study of domestic violence during pregnancy appears in BJOG, an international journal of obstetrics and gynecology. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The special UN investigator on freedom of religion or belief is calling for the universal repeal of blasphemy laws. He says that they restrict freedom of expression and promote hatred and intolerance towards minority religions. The investigator has submitted his report to the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva. Lisa Schlein has more on the story.
Human rights expert Heine Bielefeld says freedom of religion and freedom of expression are mutually reinforcing, allowing both rights to flourish, but that blasphemy laws cast a pall over these basic rights. He says religious minorities suffer most from the chilling effects the laws create. Bielefeld says Pakistan is known for its draconian blasphemy laws that even carry the death penalty. Although the ultimate sentence has never been carried out, he says many people accused of blasphemy are on death row. The investigator says studies show that religious minorities in Pakistan who suffer disproportionately from the laws include Shias, Christians, and Ahmadis, who are accused of not being true Muslims. But he notes numerous countries in the Middle East, Southeast Asia, Central Asia, and even Europe have blasphemy laws on the books. He says Germany, Denmark, Poland, and Greece either have laws that hark back to the old colonial period or what he calls post-blasphemy laws. These, he says, are not meant to honor God, but to protect religious feelings. He tells VOA that Russia also has tightened its blasphemy laws.
Russia, also in the Human Rights Council, now really has taken over the torch from Pakistan to argue for the protection of the feelings of ordinary believers, which means mainly, of course, Orthodox believers. So usually these blasphemy laws protect majorities, the feelings of majorities, while minorities pay the price.
In the interest of clarity and credibility, Bielefeld says European countries should clean up the old-fashioned blasphemy and post-blasphemy laws as the Parliamentarian Assembly of the Council of Europe has demanded. While the laws are largely associated with Muslim countries, he says they also exist within Hindu, Buddhist, and Christian societies. He says they often are used to stifle critical voices and breed intolerance, discrimination, and hatred against people based on religious belief. In Central Asian countries and Russia, Bielefeld says religious minorities increasingly are being targeted and arrested in the name of fighting extremism. While fighting extremism is a legitimate concern, he says this must not be done at the expense of restricting people's basic human rights. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour. I'm the Voice of America.
Is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.
Looking for the day's biggest news stories? Then start your day with Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Daybreak's 30-minute program comes to you Monday through Friday at 300, 400, 500, and 600 UTC. We are also live on the Internet at www.voaafrica.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. A new report says 34 countries, nearly all of them in Africa, do not have enough food for their populations. And armed conflicts around the world showed no signs of abating in 2015 and have had a devastating impact on children. Coming up, we'll have music from Nigeria and our feature report, Training Displaced Women on How to Run Small Businesses in South Sudan. I'm Kim Lewis with the Hayes Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. And, of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with the mighty, mighty Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sonny Young this week. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Kim.
What's on tap today?
Well, Kim, we start off with the upcoming World Indoor Championships.
Great.
Thank you very much. A sprinter Sean Safia Twi has been cleared to switch allegiance from Great Britain to Ghana. The 25-year-old won the 60-meter at the Glasgow Indoor Grand Prix and finished third at the British Indoor Championships in February. His application to the International Association of Athletics Federations was not opposed by British Athletics. Sao Antwi will now likely make the Ghanaian squad for the World Indoor Championships in Portland here in the USA. The World Championships take place from 17th to 20th March. Meanwhile, 3 years after breaking the course record at the Hanover Marathon, Lusapho April will return to the IAAF Silver Label Road Race on April 10th. One of South Africa's leading marathon runners, April clocked 2:08.32 on the flat course in central Germany in 2013, which still remains a personal best and course record. Having also won in 2011, April will be chasing a record third win in Hanover. It will be April's fifth appearance in Hanover, and each time he has run quicker than the previous occasion. But it won't be an easy task for the 33-year-old. Jacob Chesari is one of five strong Kenyans in this year's field, and he will be defending his title from 2015. Last year, Chesari defeated five runners with superior personal bests to win in 2:09.32, the 31-year-old personal best of 2:07.46 was also set in Germany when finishing fourth at the 2013 Frankfurt Marathon.
If you would like to leave a voicemail for possible use on a future Sunny Side of Sports broadcast, please call 1-202-205-9942. Once again, that number, 1-202-205-9942.
VOA!
When you hear the VOA identification, press 60, and please include your name and where you are calling from.
Voice of America!
Hello, this is Magnus Chisholm calling from Imo State in Nigeria. I love listening to the Sunny Side of Sports. It's always a daily delight of listening to the Sunny Side of Sports. Once again, Magnus Chisholm on with you calling from Imo State in Nigeria and wishing all the Sunny Side of Sports listeners all the best. Bye.
Because this is Africa. Zamina, mina, eh, eh. Waka, waka, eh, eh. Zamina, mina, sakalewa. This time for Africa.
I'm very excited.
Because this is Africa. Zamina, mina, eh, eh. Waka, waka, eh, eh. Zamina, mina, sakalewa. This time for Africa.
Yes, this is indeed the Sunny Side of Sports coming to you live from Washington. Now, for more sports news, let's go to Johannesburg, South Africa, and join Daybreak Africa's Mark Ouma, who begins with football.
The Confederation of African Football, CAF, Secretary General Hicham El Amrani says they have thrown their full weight behind the Zimbabwe Football Association, ZIFA's, move to stamp out match-fixing in some of their upcoming international competitions. ZIFA President Philip Chiyangwa told the Harare media on Wednesday that they have suspended ZIFA committee member Edzai Kasinauyo and assistant national team coach Nation Dube over alleged match-fixing as part of an ongoing investigation. Chiyangwa reckons they have strong evidence of wrongdoing, which they will forward to CAF and FIFA for further action. On a more cheerful note, Angola is determined to qualify for the Futsal World Cup in Colombia later this year. To achieve this, they must place among the top three at the Africa Futsal Championships in Johannesburg, South Africa next month. Angola start their Group B campaign against Morocco, then Africa's top side Egypt and the 2008 Africa Champions Libya. Speaking through an interpreter, I asked Angola's coach Libanya Lopez what he makes of the draws.
É uma série bastante difícil, é a série da morte, mas é a nossa sorte.
Okay, it's a very difficult group actually, but that is a group that we are. So we are prepared for that. Very difficult. We don't have to choose the adversaries. We have to play. We recently was prepared in Brazil with one of the best teams in the world. And definitely we're going to fight and make it.
Angola played at the last Futsal World Cup, and you see they have to fight Egypt, the best team, and Libya, the defending champions. Is there any target? What is the target for the Angola team?
Angola is coming to South Africa futsal competition to actually qualify for the World Cup. Angola is in this group, Libya, Morocco. Actually, we're going to face them, but our main purpose is to qualify for the World Cup.
That was Libanya Lopez, the Angola men's futsal national team coach, speaking in Johannesburg, South Africa. And that's it. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kHz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kHz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
Well, it's Thursday and we are approaching that time to enjoy the weekend matches in the European leagues. As usual, let's look at how African players are doing, and we turn to our football guru, David Legg in Johannesburg, South Africa. David, the African players in Europe seem to be performing very well lately. Why don't we start with the English Premier League?
Yeah, good point, Douglas. Last week, we were bemoaning the fact that no Africans scored in the English Premier League. So they obviously listened into the show and they decided to show us what they were capable of. Because we had a string of African goals in the EPL. Well done to all our players playing in the... certainly, maybe not the top league in the world. I think you could argue that's the La Liga in Spain. But it is definitely the most watched league in the world. It's got an amazing worldwide interest. And Riyad Mahrez, the Algerian, who's been in outstanding form for the shock EPL league leaders, Leicester City, He scored the only goal for the Foxes, as they're known. And that gave them a 1-0 victory away to Watford. And what it did, Douglas, is it extended Leicester's lead over second place Tottenham Hotspur to 5 points. There are 9 rounds left. And I think it's safe to say that if Leicester City can stay on top and pull off this title, it will be undoubtedly the most sensational finish to an EPL. For so many years now, English football has been dominated by the likes of Arsenal, Chelsea, Manchester United, Manchester City, even my own favourite club, Liverpool. They faded a bit in the last decade or so, but they were always up there. But Leicester City, they were a team that you always looked on as one that was going to fight to avoid relegation. So it's a truly amazing story. And one of the real stars of that team this year has been Riyad Mahrez. West Africans were also in outstanding form. A name to watch out for is young Bertrand Traoré. He's from Burkina Faso. He plays for Chelsea. He scored against Stoke City in a 1-1 draw. And that was his 4th goal in 5 appearances for Chelsea. So well done to him. Senegalese were also on top form. Mama Biram Diouf of Stoke City, formerly of Manchester United. He scored the equaliser for Stoke at Chelsea. Diafra Sakho, another Senegalese, he plays for West Ham United. He scored one of the goals in the comeback at the weekend. West Ham United, who are now 5th on the table and challenging for a Champions League place, they were trailing Everton at Goodison Park by 2 goals, but stormed back to win the match by 3-2. Yaya Touré, 4-time African Footballer of the Year, runner-up this time round to Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. He was on target, the first of 4 goals for City in a 4-0 victory over Aston Villa. Aston Villa, club with a great tradition, but sadly they seem to be doomed at the bottom of the table, and they're heading for the Championship, which is the second tier of English football. There were also, Douglas, some African goals in Spain. The Senegalese midfielder Alfred Ndiaye scored for Real Betis in a vital 2-0 victory over Granada. But bad news for all our Cameroon listeners. Their star goalkeeper, Carlos Kameni, who plays for Malaga, he was injured in a 3-3 draw against Deportivo La Coruña, and the prognosis is not good. It seems as if he will be out of action with a knee injury for at least 2 months, and that means he's going to miss later this month 2 vital games for Cameroon, home and away against South Africa in Group M. Those games effectively are going to be the title deciders for that particular group. At the moment, Cameroon are really sitting pretty. They've got 6 points, and the South African Bafana Bafana have only got 1. Normally, when we talk about Germany, Douglas, we talk about Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, and we talk about goals, but not this week. Borussia Dortmund, his club, played against Bayern Munich in a top-of-the-table clash. It ended goalless, and that means that Robert Lewandowski of Bayern Munich is still top of the German scorers list with 23 goals, but breathing down his neck, hot on his heels, is Aubameyang with 22 goals. And Aubameyang this year ending that great run of Yaya Touré by snatching the 2015 African Footballer of the Year title. Douglas?
Yes, David, it seems the African players in Europe are making their mark.
They are. I mean, they're doing really well. I was shocked last week, Douglas. No African goals at all in the EPL, because to me, that's one of the highlights of the weekend. I go through the fixtures, then I go through the results and the scorers, and the first thing I look out for is how many Africans have scored. Another player I should mention, actually, is the Egyptian Mohamed Salah. Now, he's officially with Chelsea, but he's been on loan to several clubs, and the most recent of those is Roma in Italy. And he bagged another brace as Roma trashed Fiorentina 4-1. So Salah, among the strikers who are in outstanding form. But the real find of the season, Douglas, to me, is this Riyad Mahrez. You know, the story goes that Leicester City actually went to France to watch a match in which Mahrez was involved, but they didn't go to see Mahrez at all. They went to see another player. But it was the Algerian who caught the eye of the spies from the Foxes in the English Midlands. Mahrez moves to England for a very small fee by modern standards. And now this season, playing on the right wing, he's not a central striker at all. He's actually a winger. technically a midfield player. He has scored 15 goals for Leicester City. It's a fairy tale beyond belief, this. Leicester City, perennial strugglers at the top of the table, looking down on the likes of Tottenham, Arsenal. I mean, Manchester United, the great Manchester United, are 13 points behind Leicester with 9 rounds to go. Douglas?
David, our football guru in Johannesburg, South Africa. Talking of football, today is Samuel Eto'o's birthday, the most decorated African player of all time. Samuel Eto'o today celebrates his 35th birthday. While the striker's achievements on the pitch are legendary at both club and international level, off the pitch, the Cameroonian superstar is maybe less known for his social engagement in Africa, giving back to the continent he long ago became a symbol for. Among other things, towards the end of last year, the former Real Madrid, Barcelona and Inter Milan forward joined a FIFA delegation to Sierra Leone and Ghana to experience firsthand the progress of FIFA's health campaigns. As well as visiting the Crafton Orphanage in Freetown, Sierra Leone, which takes care of very young children who lost their entire families to the Ebola virus, Eto'o also visited local schools in Sierra Leone and Ghana to communicate and promote the lessons FIFA 11 for Health looks to share. So, a sunny side of sports, happy birthday to Samuel Eto'o. And that's it for this edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm Douglas Impoga. Now back to you, Kim.
Thank you, Douglas. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, training displaced women on how to run small business in South Sudan. But first, some music. Here is Chief Stephen Ostis Osodibi from Nigeria with Osindi Owindi.
Sunday.
Chief Stephen Austis Osedibi from Nigeria with Osondi Owondi.
In South Sudan, a local NGO is training displaced women on how to run small businesses so they can provide for themselves and their families. Hundreds of people who fled their homes to escape recent violence in rural parts of Wau County are living in crowded homes with relatives in Wau Town. The Women's Development Group says equipping the IDPs with new life skills will allow them to become self-reliant. Michael Atit has this report for VOA from WOW.
A trainer interacts with several women taking part in the small business skills training workshop in WOW. Anthony Albino Miskin, coordinator for Women Development Group in WOW, says many families who fled to WOW town from rural areas have nothing. Albino says his group is training more than 50 displaced women on how to start a small-scale business.
There are people in rural area that depend on agricultural activity. Now they are in new environment in town. For us, we want to train them so that they can know skill on business environment, and how to deal with the customer, how you can manage your business, how to make a plan for the business.
Albino says, following the training, each of the women will be given 1,000 South Sudanese pounds to start a business of their choice. 36-year-old Farida Fausto, a mother of five who fled the fighting from Frajala, says members of an armed group burned all her belongings, leaving her with nothing. Fausto says after gaining business skills she learned from the NGO, she will return to her village where she hopes to set up a small business. Speaking in Arabic, she says she has learned how to manage the little money she earns through tea making and how to maintain the capital grant.
Wau is a town and is so costly because in the village we don't buy anything like charcoal, firewood, or water. Now we are here in the town and it has affected our life, and this training is good to help us being in new life here. We are really appealing to our government and opposition group to come together and solve their differences so we can go back to our normal life in the village.
46-year-old Asunta Marco Kola, a mother of eight, fled violence in Gisa area. She says although she found life in Wau too difficult, she has learned a lot from skills training and hopes to start a new life here. Speaking in Arabic, Kola says she would like to start selling charcoal, peanut butter, and maize flour in front of her house in Wau.
I'm ready to start selling charcoal on the street, and it will help me to find something to keep my kids alive. I have learned how to keep the capital money and how to use the benefits wisely. I think our life will improve here in the town.
Albino says his organization will follow up with the trainees after a month to see what progress they have made. He says he understands the challenges women face as they try to start new lives far from the rural areas.
We know it will be a challenge for them, for the business, but we will be with them to monitor them, to know their activity. We expect change. They will change. Their life will change.
The second phase of the training is expected to start in 2 weeks' time. Last week, authorities from the South Sudan Relief and Rehabilitation Commission in Wau said there were more than 38,000 IDPs who fled the recent fighting in Wau County. Pons Filberto Mboro, the director of South Sudan Relief and Rehabilitation Commission in Wau, says they are working with other humanitarian actors to assess the conditions of the IDPs to help women. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Wau.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer Bill Workinger and our engineer Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Last year, malaria sickened over 214 million people across the globe and killed some 438,000 of them. And although the disease is relatively common in tropical and subtropical regions, 90% of the deaths occurred in Africa. Most of them were children under 5 years of age. But consider that since the turn of the century, deaths from malaria have fallen by half. According to the World Health Organization, in the year 2000, 985,000 people succumbed to the disease. Today, malaria is in retreat due to a strong global push to reduce deaths and illness. More than 100 countries are now malaria-free, and another 57 cut their incidence of malaria by at least three quarters. 10 years ago, President George W. Bush founded the President's Malaria Initiative, a historic U.S. government effort to lead the fight against malaria. His successor, President Barack Obama, expanded the effort, eventually doubling its funding. Today, the initiative focuses on 19 of the hardest-hit countries in sub-Saharan Africa and three countries in Southeast Asia. Our investment has been well worth the effort. Since the launching of the President's Malaria Initiative, or PMI, led by USAID and implemented together with the CDC, overall mortality rates among children under 5 years of age have significantly decreased in the target countries, anywhere from 18% in both Liberia and Nigeria to 55% in Senegal and Zambia. Last year alone, PMI funded the spraying of the homes of over 16 million people and procured around 42 million long-lasting insecticide-treated bed nets. The United States also provided 60 million anti-malarial treatments and more than 54 million rapid diagnostic tests. In his State of the Union address in January, President Obama set forth a long-term vision of ending the disease. Noting that the end of HIV/AIDS is now within our grasp, he said, "We have the chance to accomplish the same thing with malaria." For that reason, the Obama administration requested from the U.S. Congress an extra $200 million to fight malaria worldwide, which would bring next year's total U.S. funding for prevention and treatment of the disease to $874 million. With additional funds, PMI will increase support to malaria-affected countries to further reduce malaria deaths and substantially decrease malaria illness toward the long-term goal of elimination. The United States is committed to ending this disease that prematurely ends the lives of so many people, especially children. And we call on all our partners, including non-governmental and international organizations, countries and communities, to join our efforts.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Looking for the day's biggest news stories? Then start your day with Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Daybreak's 30-minute program comes to you Monday through Friday at 300, 400, 500, and 600 UTC. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.